Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome. This is Blog Talk Radio with Donna Crowe. And today our broadcast is on diabetes, and our special guest is Mr. Smith, Mr. Thomas Smith. He's the author of Insulin, Our Silent Killer. He was our guest a few weeks ago, and there's just so much information that we decided to schedule a few more broadcasts. And last week we had trouble, so this week I think we got it. So hold on one second here. I'm going to see if I can get Mr. Smith in and get his mic on. Mr. Smith, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Excellent. Yes, I've got you, and you're live right now. So anyway, everyone, welcome to our broadcast. Thank you, Mr. Smith, for being here. I want to do just a little bit of recapping, and then we're going to take off and let him have the reins and go into the subject in depth. So one of the reasons I wanted to have these broadcasts is because diabetes has increased in the last 50 years 700%. 700%, that's a huge number. And this is a disease that is causing an unbelievable amount of suffering in people, because it's not just, well, my blood sugar's out of balance and I just take a pill and we balance it and everything's fine. No, it's the number one cause of blindness, amputation, and kidney failure. And before blindness happens, before amputation happens, before kidney failure happens, there's just years of incredible suffering, severe pain, and just, it affects your brain, your thinking, everything. I mean, it just is a horrible, horrible way to live. It's a lot of suffering, and it's preventable. It's entirely preventable, and it's entirely treatable. I'm not the only one saying this. Mr. Smith himself was diagnosed with diabetes. He turned it around really quickly, and he has spent many, many years being completely free of this problem. And there are a multitude of people out there. There's books out there that tell you how to turn it around. His book is one of my favorites, probably is my favorite. And one of the reasons I really like his book is because it gives you enough information to know what you're dealing with. It doesn't just treat you like you're a child and just say, don't eat this, do eat that. It tells you why your body has come into an imbalanced state and tells you the history of diet and how this has happened and why it's an epidemic. And, you have to make dietary changes, and people that don't understand what's going on in their body have less, fortitude, less motivation. When you really know what is happening in your physical body when you put certain foods in it, it gives you a lot more fortitude and willpower to make the right choice. His book is just excellent. And so I just want to tell you, you can get his book directly from him. You can email him at Valley at F as in Frank, R as in Roger, II.com. Very easy email. That's Valley at FRII.com. It's $29.95. I believe that includes shipping. Is that correct?
Yes, $29, and it includes shipping, yes.
$29. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you can email him, and he'll tell you exactly how to do that. So I just want to let you know that up front.
You can just send a check or money order to Thomas Smith at Post Office Box 7685, Loveland, Colorado, 80537. We ship books about twice a week, every week, all over the world.
Let's do that a little bit slower. So it's P.O. Box
7685.
7685, because I know some of the people who are listening are not feeling good, and so it takes them a while to write these numbers down. So it's the Post Office Box 7.
That's Thomas Smith, Post Office Box 7685.
85,
Loveland, Colorado, 80537.
So the zip code is 80537, okay? So you can either email him or just go ahead and send him a check with your information, and he'll get it right out to you. if I had diabetes, I would not only have this book, I'd have three or four others. You know, for a few $100 in books, you can really understand what's happening to you. Different people have it from different angles. Some have recipes, some have don't. You know, but for very little money, you can fix yourself, and you can get past an incredible amount of suffering if you're already dealing with diabetes. What you don't want to do is you don't want to use traditional medicines recommendations. There are people out there who are dealing with this naturally who understand it, you know, and Mr. Smith will talk about this a little bit later, that the recommended diet by the medical profession will actually cause diabetes. Okay,
yes,
so I know people out there are going, oh my God, who can I trust? You know, well, I'm going to tell you, you can trust Mr. Smith. And I will give you some names of a few other publications at the very end of the last broadcast that can be options also that can help you understand that he's not the only one saying that you can do it right with your diet. And they're all in agreement about what you put in and how it affects your blood sugar control system. So, again, diabetes has increased 700% in the last 50 years. That's just insane. That's just insane. I was reading a statistic recently that said that 50% of Latino children born now are expected to have diabetes. That's just not right. That's, you know, you got to wake up at some point and go, what? Why is this happening? And it's our diet, and it's because our diet is not, it's just not real. It's manufactured food, manufactured ingestibles. It's not real food. So we're going to talk about that today. But I want people to know this is not just diabetes. Insulin imbalance, you know, your blood sugar control system not working properly is at the root of the main diseases that we deal with, which is heart disease. You mentioned peripheral vascular disease, macular degeneration, stroke, high blood pressure, cancer, obesity, dementia, inflammation. This is just some of the things that are related to insulin. So this program is about much more than just diabetes. If you want to prevent these things, then you want to listen to this program, and you want to get everybody that you know and love to listen to this. Mr. Smith is not the only one saying this. The government is saying this, and they're saying that these are diseases of lifestyle and diet. They are preventable and curable. I'm going to read once again what I read in the first broadcast because not everybody's going to listen to every piece of it. So I just want to read a few paragraphs to you. Now this, I want to tell you exactly where this is coming from. This is coming from Dietary Goals for the United States. This is prepared by the staff of the Select Committee on Nutrition and Human Needs for the by the United States Senate. Okay, so this is, you know, an official government publication, and this is what they say. As a nation, we have come to believe that medicine and medical technology can solve our major health problems. The role of such important factors as diet in cancer and heart disease has long been obscured by the emphasis on the conquest of these diseases through the miracles of modern medicine. Treatment, not prevention, has been the order of the day. Then they go on to say, ischemic heart disease, cancer, diabetes, hypertension, these kinds of diseases that kill us, they are epidemic in our population, and we cannot afford to temporize. We have an obligation to inform the public of the current state of knowledge and to assist the public in making the correct food choices. To do less is to avoid our responsibility. And then one final quote. This says, there is a widespread and unfounded confidence in the ability of medical science to cure or mitigate the effects of such diseases once they occur. Appropriate public education must emphasize the unfortunate but clear limitations of current medical practice in curing the common killer diseases. Once hypertension, diabetes, arterial sclerosis, or heart disease are manifest, there is, in reality, very little that medical science can do to return a patient to normal physiological function. As awareness of this limitation increases, the importance of prevention will become all the more obvious. So what I want to encourage people with is, though, you know, medical science can't do anything to return a patient to normal physiological function, your diet can. And this is what they're saying. They're saying these diseases are diet and lifestyle. You can't control these things. You can't prevent these things with diet and lifestyle. And one of the major, you know, one of the things that Mr. Smith talked about last time was he broke down our diet, basically, protein, carbs, you know, fats and oils. And, you know, his instructions were that protein is a basic construction material. Carbs are our fuel source, but fats and oils are building blocks, and they can be a secondary fuel source, but fats and oils are major building blocks for our cells, for our brain, for our nerves, for prostaglandins. They're extremely important in the body's ability to process insulin. And so part of the picture, a big part of the dietary picture is fats and oils. And there's so much confusion out there. People are like, you know, listening to advertisements, you would think that everything in the grocery store was just straight from heaven and it's just going to bless you and benefit you. You know, it's like, I just think about all the commercials that I've seen on Wesson oil and corn oil and how wonderful it is for you. And now we've got canola oil, and oh, canola oil is just like the savior of the day. And then when you tell people, no, these are not good for you, it's like serious confusion. And we're so brainwashed by these commercials and things that we see on TV that we really think that when somebody comes along and says, no, this is not good, we're suspect of them because we believe the commercials. We believe these nice people that have these slick ads that these things are good for us, and they're not. They're deadly, and they're part of the reason we have so much diabetes now, a 700% increase, has to do with fats and oils. So that's where I'm going to stop, and I'm going to say, okay, Mr. Smith, thank you so much for being here. I just can't even tell you how much I appreciate you sharing your knowledge.
Well, I hope so, I can help some people out.
Yeah, absolutely. Take it away.
Type 2 diabetes is the principal form of diabetes, and it's been renamed. It used to be called adult onset diabetes. And the reason they renamed it is because it's becoming epidemic in 4 to 6-year-olds who are not yet even adults. So they couldn't keep calling it adult onset diabetes. That's where the name type 2 diabetes came from.
Isn't that scary? That just is so sad to me.
Prior to 1949, heart failure and degenerative heart disease was known to be a symptom of diabetes. And in 1949, the whole medical community was reorganized, and they formed a lot of specialty groups, and each specialty group sort of glommed onto a bunch of symptoms and redefined them as diseases and made them their specialty. So if you go to a heart specialist today, he will treat you for a bunch of symptoms, all of which are caused by diabetes, but he does not treat you for diabetes because, as far as he's concerned, it's an unrelated issue. So much for the medical community.
That's a scary thought. So basically, they're specializing in just the heart, and they're just ignoring
everything
the whole
they do. Has the effect of bringing a lot of money into their coffers, but it doesn't have anything to do with improving your health. Anyway.
So their main focus is on pharmaceutical drugs to treat your symptoms. They have no focus on diet lifestyle. I shouldn't say no, but very few doctors focus on diet and lifestyle. It's mainly a medication to try to alter your body chemistry and fake it out and try and stop certain symptoms, but it doesn't heal anything. It doesn't fix anything.
Yeah.
So
anyway,
what you're saying is you don't address the
whole host of degenerative diseases, including diabetes and all of the concomitant diseases that go with diabetes. It's fats and oils. It's a central issue. What's causing it. The diseases started to show up in the 1930s at the same time that our fats and oils industry kicked into high gear and started processing very large quantities of fats and oils and bottling it, putting it in the stores. So today I was going to focus almost entirely on fats and oils, and we're going to talk a lot about them. And hopefully we'll get a good understanding of some of the buzzwords that are bandied about. We'll know what a fat or oil is, what the difference is. Before I get into this, I want to issue a warning. And I'm going to repeat this warning at the end of the show, and then somewhere along the middle of the show, I'm going to explain why I'm issuing this warning.
All right.
The warning is, if you wish to remain healthy, do not consume canola oil, soybean oil, or cottonseed oil, and do not consume any food products that contain any of them as ingredients. Okay?
Okay, so that was canola?
Canola, soybean, and cottonseed.
Soy and cottonseed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right.
In a more general sense, you could extend that to what's called the polyunsaturates, which are the oils that are higher in omega-6s. Anyway, fat and oil? All fats and oils are triglycerides. That is, they consist of three fatty acids connected to a glycerol backbone. The end that connects to the glycerol backbone is called the acid end, and the other end is terminated by a methyl group. There are other molecules such as phospholipids, which is a diglyceride. They also play very important roles in human health, but strictly speaking, they are not fats or oils. Fats or oils are all triglycerides. A phospholipid has two fatty acids and a phosphorus molecule attached to its glycerol backbone.
Okay.
Glycerol, by the way, is a water-attracting material, glycerin. And glycerin is a useful treatment for dehydration. But you get a lot of glycerin when you consume triglycerides. You don't have to take any extra glycerin.
Right.
So what's a fatty acid? This is where the story gets murky as far as the sales community is concerned, but not according to the scientific community. Carbon atoms have a tendency to connect together in long chains, 18, 20, 24 carbon molecules connected together. And when they're in these long chains, they have each carbon molecule connects to another one, like chain links in a chain. And each carbon molecule can also connect to two additional hydrogen molecules that are typically attached to its sides. So a fatty acid is a long chain of carbon molecules with hydrogen atoms attached to its sides, both sides of the chain, with a methyl terminator at one end and an acid terminator at the other. And the acid terminator connects to a glycerol molecule, which forms the triglyceride when you have three of them. Okay, you want to get that picture. Now,
I'm writing this down. So the acid terminator on the end connects to glycerin.
Yeah, and the methyl end is just open.
Okay.
And the number of carbon atoms is variable, and it's called the chain length. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, these chains of carbons, these fatty acids, come in a variety of different forms. For example, if all of the binding spots along the carbon chain are filled with hydrogen molecules, all of them,
mm-hmm.
then you have what's called a saturated fatty acid, saturated fat.
Right.
All the binding spots are full, that's where it's saturated. Typical saturated fats run from very short chain fatty acids, of maybe four carbon molecules, to the very long ones, like oligocentric acid, which has 24. So there really aren't very many saturated fatty acids. Most of them are very, very healthy, particularly the short and medium chain ones are very, very healthy. And one of the really terrible things that's happened to the American diet is they have been removed from our diet. Short and medium chain saturated fatty acids.
Can you name a few of those?
Oh, some of them are in coconut oil, palm oil, butter. Butyric acid is a short chain fatty acid. Now, when we start looking at the chain of atoms and carbon atoms, and ask, well, what happens when some of the hydrogen bonds are missing? Some of the hydrogen atoms are missing. Well, this is called a double bond. The carbon atom will bind to itself twice at that particular location. All right? And these are called, now we're talking, if it happens once along the carbon chain, then we call it a monounsaturated. If it happens more than once, we call it a polyunsaturated fatty acid.
Okay.
The two essential fatty acid families, the omega-3s and the omega-6s, are polyunsaturated fatty acids. If the unfilled sites, that is, the sites along the carbon chain that are missing their hydrogen atom, if they're all on the same side of the carbon chain, then we call it a cis-type fatty acid, and the chain is bent or it's kinked at the place where the hydrogen is missing and where you have a double bond of carbon. The more unfilled sites you have or the more double bonds you have, the more the carbon chain is bent. This bending of the carbon chain gives these unsaturated fatty acids their very helpful properties. This is what makes them very, very useful to the body. So a trans fatty acid is formed when the unfilled binding sites appear on both sides of the carbon chain. In this case, the chain remains straight, just as if it were a saturated fat. Matter of fact, the body has trouble telling it apart from a saturated fat. The body sees it to be a long, straight carbon chain and sometimes assumes that it's a saturated fat. This is why when the body doesn't really know what to do with a trans fatty acid, it stores it in its fat cells. That's why they get stored in fat cells, because the body, not knowing what they are, not knowing how to deal with them, just assumes that they're a saturated fat. In the sales literature of fats and oils, you run into terms like polyunsaturated and monounsaturated. They apply equally well to both the cis type, which are the healthy type fatty acids, and the trans fatty acids, which are the synthetic fatty acids that cause so much trouble.
Okay,
many
can
trans
I just,
fatty acids are polyunsaturated.
Mr. Smith,
yes.
Can I just interrupt just for a second? I just want to make sure I'm getting this clear. So I'm going to just briefly sort of recap to see if I'm getting a clear picture. So you've got a long chain of carbon molecules. That's a fatty acid. So I'm going to picture like a chain of pearls. And then off of those chain of pearls, there are other little molecules that are hydrogen molecules.
Just hydrogen atoms.
Hydrogen atoms.
Much smaller than the carbon atom.
Okay. And so then...
Like take a look at that
If that long chain of carbon molecules, if that pearl necklace of carbon atoms, if on both sides of it, if it's absolutely filled with hydrogen molecules, then it's considered a saturated fat.
That's correct.
Okay. So then,
there are about 25 or so saturated fats.
Okay. So then a mono unsaturated fat is like there's one hydrogen molecule.
One hydrogen's missing.
Okay. And then if it's polyunsaturated, then there's more than one hydrogen molecule missing.
That's right.
Hydrogen atom. Okay.
Actually, more than one pair of hydrogen molecules missing.
Okay. Now, can you explain again the cis and the trans? Because I'm not clear on that. So,
with the cis fatty acid, all of the missing hydrogens are on the same side of the chain.
Okay.
And because they're missing, they cause the chain to be kinked or bent at that point.
Okay. Okay.
With a trans fatty acid, they're missing on both sides of the chain, and
okay.
So the chain remains straight.
All righty. Okay, I think I've got it now.
Okay.
All right.
The difference between a healthy and an unhealthy fat is the difference between a cis-type fatty acid and a trans fatty acid.
Okay.
Now we're going to get into the next part we're going to get into here is a little bit, I'm going to try and make it as understandable as possible, but it's inherently a little tricky to understand. So,
okay, well, I might interrupt you here and there just to make sure everybody's clear.
Because
I know people are thinking, oh, you know, I feel like I'm in medical school or something, and this is like, I don't want to know all this. Trust me.
You need to know it. I'm not talking about anything on this show that isn't going to be extremely helpful to you. When
exactly.
You find yourself wandering around the supermarket, wondering what to do about the fats and oils you see on the shelf.
Exactly. And so if you want actual
I'm telling
truth,
you something you need to know, or I wouldn't tell you.
Absolutely.
Believe me.
So,
preparing
the
notes for the show, I left out a whole lot more information than I included on a theory that maybe it wasn't as necessary. But this is necessary. I'm down to the minimum.
Absolutely. So I'm wanting people to know that it might be complicated. You might think, oh, I don't want to know all this, but you do. You do want to know it. If you have to go back and listen to it 3 or 4 times, it's free. It's there in the archives. Make sure you understand this because it's going to empower you when you get to the grocery store to know
if you don't understand
real
this,
and
not willing to put out the effort to understand it, you're going to be a perpetual victim in the supermarket.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's go.
All right, we're going to talk now about unsaturated fatty acid identification. When they talk about unsaturated fatty acids, okay,
mm-hmm.
They talk about their common names and their nicknames. All right?
Yeah.
Example, I'll give you a bunch of examples here to kind of clarify it.
Okay.
Nicknames such as LNA. This is an abbreviation for an acid whose name is alpha-linolenic acid, whose proper given name is all-cis omega-3-6-9-octadecacentrionic acid.
Good Lord.
That's the real name of it. It's referred to as alpha-linolenic, and
right.
The nickname is LNA.
Okay.
Okay? This is an essential fatty acid. It's an omega-3. It's an essential family of fatty acids because it has some derivatives.
Okay.
To make matters a little more unnecessarily complicated, this particular very common necessary fatty acid is also miscalled, misnamed linolenic. It's supposed to be alpha-linolenic.
Okay.
All right. There is also a descriptive structural formula abbreviation that's widely used to sort of simplify matters. It simply states the length of the carbon chain, the number of unfilled bonds, the location of the first unfilled bond, counted from the end opposite to the backbone connection, and it is assumed and left unstated that it's a cis configuration. Now, I'll give you some examples, and then it'll get simpler. The example I just gave you is alpha-linolenic acid, known as ALA.
Mm-hmm.
Its structural abbreviation is 18,3-omega-3. 18,3-omega-3. 18 is the number of carbon atoms in the chain. 3 is the number of unfilled bonds. They're sometimes called double bonds. And omega-3 is the position from the methyl end of the carbon location of the first double bond.
This, wow,
one of the famous essential omega-3 fatty acids. It's the parent fatty acid. Okay? I use it as an example because it's the one you really need to know the most about.
Okay.
Give me a couple more examples here. Another example would be butyric acid. This is often called a short-chain fatty acid. It happens to be a saturated fat. That means all of its binding sites are full. There are no double bonds.
How do you spell that?
Butyric. B-U-T-Y-R-I-C. You find
it. Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, you'll find it in what?
Butter.
Butter, okay.
Structural formula for it is 4:0. That means 4 carbon atoms and no double bonds, no unfilled locations.
Okay.
I'll give you an omega-6 example here. Another example would be linoleic acid. Its proper name is cis omega-6,9-octadecadienionic acid. Its formula is 18,2-omega-6. This is the most common and essential omega-6 parent acid. And it states that it has 18 carbon atoms, 2 unfilled bonds, with the first one starting at position 6 from the methyl end. Okay?
Okay. Alrighty.
Some of our listeners may want to listen to that again.
Yeah, absolutely.
But now, essential fatty acids, we just used as a couple of examples the two families of essential fatty acids. They appear in omega-3s and 6s. And the reason they're called essential is because the human body cannot create them. The human system requires them, and in fact, it requires them to appear in a ratio of about 3 or 4 to 1. That is, 3 or 4 times as much omega-6 as omega-3. Up until the early part of the 20th century, that's the way our diet was structured. We had 3 or 4 times omega-6 as omega-3 in our diet. And when we had them, our country was relatively free from degenerative disease. Now, omega-3, called LNA, is the parent oil from which we make EPA and DHA. SDA is another omega-3 daughter oil. You don't hear too much about. Omega-6 is the other family of essential fatty acids. Its nickname is LA. It's a parent oil from which we make GLA, DGLA, which appears in breast milk, and arachidonic acid, AA. Arachidonic acid is involved with system inflammation and the making of PG2s. Now, I want to call your attention to this. This is the omega-6 family of fatty acids is involved in making the end product, arachidonic acid, which is involved with system inflammation and the making of PG2s. We're going to come back to that.
Okay.
Starting with the commercialization of the fats and oils industry in the early 1920s, this ratio of 3 or 4 to 1 between omega-6s and omega-3s began to change, and disease began to appear. Today, the omega-6 to omega-3 ratio is between 20 and 30 to 1. The country is a hotbed of raging degenerative disease specifically because of this. In fact, the system is so distorted that the term polyunsaturates has changed its meaning. It used to mean a polyunsaturate was an oil that had a number of double bonds or a number of unfilled hydrogen sites. But it has come to mean almost exclusively an omega-6 oil that has a bunch of unfilled bonds, because there's such an overwhelming preponderance of omega-6s in our diet and an almost total absence of omega-3s. For those who do not supplement with fish oil or flax oil, they're getting virtually no omega-3s or a trivial amount of omega-3 fatty acids. One of the reasons, of course, when you start looking for the reasons why these things happen, you start asking, where's the money? Trace the money, and you find out that the omega-3 unsaturates, which are extremely rare in our diet, are very easily damaged by heat and light and oxygen. They require constant refrigeration, opaque bottles, a whole bunch of other things that you do not see in the fats and oils business.
So basically what you're saying is the quality of a good oil is damaged or destroyed by heat, light, and oxygen.
Absolutely. And they produce trans fats. These unsaturated oils are used to produce partially hydrogenated fake foods that are used as thickeners and whatnot. They interfere with normal human reproduction. They have birth control characteristics. They interfere with insulin binding and produce type 2 diabetes. They're implicated in heart attacks, osteoporosis, arteriosclerosis, strokes, heart disease, cancer, and particularly breast cancer. They cause the skin to wrinkle prematurely and illustrate other premature aging effects. The term polyunsaturates, as used in the fats and oils business by the salesman, is a misnomer. It's not only a polyunsaturate, it is an omega-6 polyunsaturate in virtually all cases, with an almost total absence of omega-3s.
Okay.
You find these omega-6s in all of the popular oils: corn oil, canola oil, cottonseed oil, soy oil, safflower oil, all of them, peanut oil. They are very common and cheap to produce oils. They're rarely packaged in opaque glass bottles or kept in the refrigerator. Very rarely, if at all.
Absolutely. So you mentioned corn and canola and safflower and peanut.
All of them. All of the popular oils, that you, without exception, with the only possible exception would be olive oil, virgin olive oil, which is a monounsaturated oil, which is usually packaged in glass and often packaged in opaque glass. But with that single exception in your supermarket, all of the other oils that are available for you to buy are not worth buying.
Okay, so don't go to the grocery store and buy oil of any kind.
Unless you want to buy virgin olive oil.
Okay.
Virgin olive oil has its place, but a healthy oil regime consists of a lot more than virgin olive oil. It just can,
absolutely.
The stuff it consists of, it just don't appear in your supermarket anymore. It's been taken out, so that all these cheap oils are substituted.
So besides the heat and the light and the oxygen, what else are these oils exposed to?
Well, they're exposed to, when we get to the point in the show, we'll talk about how the oils are made.
Okay, all right.
And we'll get into a little of that.
Okay.
The saturated fats, as I indicated, have all of their hydrogen bonds filled. There are no double bonds, and they start at the shortest one I can think of is butyric acid, which is about a 4-0. Arachidonic acid, which is an arachidonic acid, is a 20-0, and it's one of the bad guys. It's one of the fatty acids you do not want. Oligolignoceric acid is probably the longest of the saturated fats, and it's 24-0. There may be a couple of carbons longer that I didn't notice, but can't think of them right now.
Okay.
As I indicated, trans fatty acids appear when the unfilled binding sites appear on both sides of the carbon chain. A few general comments about fats and oils, and then we'll get into more specifics. All fats and oils are mixtures. In addition to the glyceride that we've the glycerol connection that we've talked about,
mm-hmm.
They typically contain fat-soluble vitamins A and D, beta-carotene, vitamin E, all the rest of the tocopherols and carotenoids and tocotrienols. They also contain phytosterols, ubiquinone, which is a popular supplement. Many of the oils contain phytoestrogens. They contain a lot of things besides just fats or oils. Many of them contain vitamins, minerals. At least they do in their natural state. When you eat the seed during the refining process, most of this good stuff's all removed. There are about 125 unsaturated fatty acids of the cis isomers at most. And there are probably many hundreds more artificial and unusual constructs, such as the trans fats, trans isomers, and others. Fats are solid at room temperature. Oils are liquid at room temperature. The longer the carbon chain, the higher the melting point. The melting point of coconut oil is right at room temperature. Temperature does not affect temperature and oxygen and light does not affect saturated fats. It affects only the unsaturated fats. This is why saturated fats can be used for cooking. And this is why unsaturated fats should never be used for cooking.
Okay.
Cis unsaturated natural fats, fatty acids, are very delicate, turn rancid very easily and quickly by the action of heat, light, or oxygen. They must be kept refrigerated at all times and packaged in opaque containers, preferably glass. Putting them in capsules and keeping them on an unrefrigerated grocery shelf will not prevent them from spoiling quickly at room temperature. So do not buy or use oils in capsules. Not only are they likely to be rancid and undetectable as such in their capsules, but you also need to take between 30 to 45 capsules per day in order to get an adequate amount. If you already have the capsules, prick one of them with a pin and squirt some of the oil on your tongue to see if it's rancid. Do not cook with unsaturated fatty acids. The only exception I would make to that is a lot of people like to cook with olive oil. It's a bad idea unless you mix the olive oil 50-50 with water. Take a cup of water and a cup of olive oil, mix them together, and then cook with them. Do stir frying or what you want to do with them. Because of the presence of the water oil mixture will not get higher than the boiling point of water. And at that temperature, the oil won't be ruined. However, if all the water boils out, the temperature will continue to go up until the oil starts to smoke, at which point it's ruined. You can't eat it.
Okay.
It used to be that that saturated animal fat was a part of a healthful diet, particularly in coal countries where there was need for higher energy, because there's a higher energy density in fat than there is in carbohydrates. Since farmers started to use toxic chemistry on their farm animals to make them grow faster and produce faster and all that, the consuming animal fat has become somewhat of a dangerous practice. And the reason is because all mammals, including man, store in their body fat any toxins that they cannot excrete from their body in a normal way. This often includes recombinant bovine growth hormone. This is why...
So lard that's rendered fat from animal
lard,
tissues would not be a good idea.
Only if it's clean lard. If lard comes from a pig that has been shot full of chemistry and fed trans fats and cottonseed and junk, then that lard is going to contain those stored toxins that animal couldn't get rid of any other way.
Okay.
There's up in Alaska, the cold country, the Eskimos up there, they have a diet of about 60% saturated fat, fish fat, whale fat, meat blubber. Their kids take a big handful of blubber and eat it like we eat candy down here. And until they changed their diet and adopted American diet, they never had any heart disease at all. So saturated fat doesn't have anything at all to do with heart disease.
This is one of those points where if you're not educated properly, you know, I remember from the time that I was, you know, a kid in school, lard was becoming very unpopular. I mean, the big thing was, oh, lard is like bad for you, you know. Don't eat lard, you know, use Crisco and some things like this, you know.
Lard is
so what you're
even with its toxin content, lard is better than Crisco. Crisco is almost pure trans fats.
So you're saying that if you can get clean lard from a healthy animal, then it's actually healthy for you.
Absolutely. It's been a staple in the human diet for thousands of years. And not only lard, but also tallow, which is beef fat or bison fat.
Okay.
This propaganda about saturated fats being bad for you was the mechanism that they used to take coconut and palm oil out of the American diet and put soybean oil in the diet and canola oil. Coconut oil and palm oil have a very high proportion of saturated fat. They're the most healthy oils we ever had in our diet. During the 1980s, they were removed because the farmer did not want, the farmer wanted to sell soybean oil because soy is a weed. He didn't have to cultivate it. It grew wild. Birds wouldn't eat it. Insects wouldn't eat it. It was easy to grow. We lost beneficial saturated fats in the American diet because of the need to introduce soybean oil, canola oil, and cottonseed oil instead. Am I making sense?
Absolutely. The other point I'd like for people to know and understand also, if they don't already, is that there was a time when very, very few people were allergic to soybeans in the United States. But South America, Brazil, they have a soybean there that's extremely, it causes great allergies in most people.
Yeah.
So what we've done in the U.S. is if we have hybridized those two, and so now people are having all kinds of soy allergies. So, you know, it just makes it even worse on top of everything else. So
soybean oil and canola oil for sure, and cottonseed oil probably, are genetically modified oils. Come from genetically modified seeds. I don't know why they bothered to genetically modify them, because the insects won't naturally eat them.
Okay.
Anyway, we talked about the bad oils. Let's talk about the good ones.
Okay.
Coconut oil, palm oil, clean tallow, butter, clean lard are all great for cooking. These are all cooking oils. Flaxseed oil, fish oil from cold water fish, hemp seed oil, cannel nut, chia, pumpkin seed oil. These are all unsaturated oils. You cannot use them for cooking.
And do you list all of these in your book?
Most of them, I think, yeah.
Okay.
In the book, I go probably more deeply into the fats and oils issue than I'm going in even here on this radio show. I'm kind of skimming the surface here because I don't want to get into so much technical detail that I lose everybody.
Yes, and you know, there's a limited amount of time. I mean, we've got 37 minutes left of an hour and a half program, so we've already covered a lot, and, you know, so you can
only
fit so much in the time slot, you know. So
pumpkin seeds and many of these oils, pumpkin seed oil, pumpkin seeds, flax oil, cold water fish, hemp seed oil. These oils, these are all very good oils. And the unsaturated oils amongst them have a lot of really beneficial properties. Remember I mentioned oils are mixtures? In addition to their glycerol molecules and fatty acids, they also contain vitamins, minerals, a lot of things. For example, pumpkin seed oil contains a lot of zinc. Men will particularly appreciate the zinc in pumpkin seeds. If they start eating pumpkin seeds instead of peanuts, they'd be a whole lot healthier and feel a whole lot better.
Yeah, I think you got cut out there a little bit, but basically you're saying pumpkin seed oil is excellent for prostate issues.
Yeah.
It's extremely healthy there, yeah.
At the beginning of the show, I mentioned a warning about canola oil, soybean oil, and cottonseed oil. I selected these three as the very worst of the polyunsaturates. All three of these oils are made from weeds or non-edible plants. Cotton is a non-edible plant. Soy is a weed. Rape is a weed. Rapeseed oil is canola oil. It's a weed. For many years, farmers have known that cottonseed foodstuffs disrupt pregnancy and harm early embryo development, and that they cause male infertility by depressed sperm counts and sperm immotility in males. This is caused by a constituent of cottonseed oil called gossypol. Cotton, not being an edible food product, is unregulated entirely insofar as the use of pesticides and herbicides is concerned, and it's full of pesticides. This is by popularizing cottonseed oil. Our government is applying birth control mechanisms to our population in order to reduce live births. Just that simple. It's birth control. Forced birth control. Canola oil. is a partially hydrogenated before being used commercially. It's classed by the EPA as a biopesticide, and it's used as an insect repellent. Insects won't eat it. It's a weed. Canola oil depresses the immune system. It is high in glycosides, which inhibit the immune function. Long-term use has been shown to damage the myelin sheath surrounding the nerves. All canola oil is genetically modified. It is a weed. Insects and birds will not attack it. It has been suspected, but not proved, of also being a birth control agent in that it suppresses the reproductive system in humans. The third one in the list is soybean oil. Soybean oil contains high levels of phytoestrogens and promote infertility and breast cancer in women. A day's worth of infant soy formula contains the equivalent of 5 birth control pills.
Oh, my gosh.
People, women, not knowing any better, are putting their infants on soybean formula, soybean oil formula. It acts to cause precocious puberty in female infants and feminization in male infants. Soy disrupts normal sexual development in both male and female infants, as well as reproduction in adults. It contains a lot of MSG, which is a potent neurotoxin. Processing of soy causes the formation of lysinosalamine, a highly toxic and highly toxic nectocenes. It's a weed. Insects and birds won't attack it. Farmers love to raise it. Soybean was the principal reason that we lost a highly beneficial group of oils, like coconut oil and palm oil. This is just a snapshot of the problems with these three major oils. Okay? I could probably do a whole radio show on the depth, in depth, on these oils. Now, if you decide, and I certainly urge you to do so, that you do not consume these oils, these three oils, and that you do not consume anything that contains them, the first major problem you're going to run into is that you will be unable to buy any salad dressings. All the salad dressings in every supermarket I have ever looked at contains one or more of these three oils.
That's absolutely right.
You would expect them to contain olive oil. It's a beneficial oil. I haven't found a single salad dressing in the supermarket that contains olive oil. They all contain canola oil, soybean oil, or cottonseed oil. So what do you do about that? That was a problem around here because we like salads. We like
That's
to
right.
take a bunch of raw vegetables and maybe some cooked shrimp or something and mix them all up in a big bowl, put some salad dressing on it, and it's a great meal.
You bet.
But we can't do it without salad dressing. And you just eat flaxseed oil and vinegar for a salad dressing. It's a very good salad dressing, but it gets old after a while.
Right.
You want to get other salad dressings that contain other herbs and spices and things. This is what you do. This is how you solve that problem. Take a little notebook and a magnifying glass to the store with you and look at all the salad dressings on the shelf and pick out the ones you like, the ones you would like to buy if you could buy them, if they were healthy. Carefully copy on all the ingredients. When you get home, scratch out the bad oils, scratch out the MSG or the natural flavors and the other suspicious stuff that's been added to these salad dressing formulations, and mix up your own salad dressing and use good oils like coconut or olive oil or palm oil or some of the good oils. flax oil. We did this. We mixed up. We copied off a few of the salad dressings that I like. Brought the recipe home. Modified the recipe to suit ourselves. Took a quart mason jar. Started mixing up our own salad dressing. Typically, it consists of stuff like olive oil, vinegar, water, stevia for sweetening, hot peppers, various other spices and whatnot to give it distinctive flavors. But you can make, in a quart mason jar, you can make enough salad dressing to last you a month. So if you do this once a month, you have solved the salad dressing problem.
Yes, and for those of you who feel like you're not very creative or don't know about, the quantities of things to put in them, there are recipes that you can find. You can, Google salad dressing recipes on the internet, and it's the same thing. They'll give you ingredients, and they may say, so much, of a particular kind of oil that you don't want to use. Just, change that out for the correct oils, and you'll have some good recipes.
Yeah. Okay, I want to take a little bit of a break from all the technical stuff that we've been discussing here.
All righty.
And tell you a little story. I call it my snake oil story. And it's a true story. And it is very, very revealing about how the pharmaceutical industry works and how the medical community works. Very revealing. Anytime you're in doubt about something they tell you, remember this story. After the Civil War in this country, they would start building a railroad to connect. They wanted to connect the East Coast to the West Coast because during that time, the only way to get from the East to the West Coast, even mail, they had to send it by Pony Express. And it took a week or 10 days for a letter to get from Sacramento to Washington, even if the Indians let the letter get through. So it was a real big problem. And so they wanted to connect the East and West Coast with a railroad. So they started building the railroad. So with 3,000 miles of laying track, and they didn't have bulldozers and backhoes and all those kind of equipment in those days. It was done with explosives and with pick and shovel and wheelbarrow. A lot of the laborers that were doing this work with Chinese laborers. And after a 14-hour day of hauling a wheelbarrow load of rock and moving things, it was usual to have bursitis and arthritis and pulled muscles and sprains and aches and pains of every kind. Well, the Chinese laborers used oil from a water snake. They rubbed their sore spots with this oil, and then it alleviated the pain very, very effectively. They told the other workers with them, and so the word started to get around in the American community about snake oil. Well, at the same time all this was going on, the country was full of what they call patent medicine hucksters. These were people that roam around from one town to another in their little wagon. And they'd give a big pitch on the back. They'd drop the tailgate down on a wagon, give a pitch to the crowd, and maybe have a magic show or something, or a girl dance or something to attract a crowd. And then they'd start selling their patent medicines. Well, when snake oil became known, they had more and more trouble selling their patent medicines. And they were selling fake cancer cures and all kinds of stuff. So they started a campaign of ridicule to ridicule snake oil. And that campaign was so effective that today, when everybody hears the word snake oil, they assume that it's an absolutely fake medicine that couldn't possibly work or do anything useful.
Right.
In fact, the term snake oil has come to mean that. Well, in 1989, Dr. Richard Kunin MD, got some samples of this water snake oil and had it analyzed. It contained over 20% EPA. EPA is omega-3 fatty acid derivative from LNA. And it plays a very large role in reducing inflammation throughout the body. This is why, in fact, it's the source of the PG1s. No, the source of the PG3s in your body, which is an very powerful anti-inflammatory. That's why snake oil works so well for these laborers on the railroad.
I love it.
Anyway, when Kunin submitted his findings to the New England Journal of Medicine, they refused to publish. They wouldn't tell anybody about it. Remember this story. Whenever you hear some huckster promoting a synthetic patent medication, the lying that goes on in the medical community and the pharmaceutical industry is just so endemic, I question whether they're even capable of telling the truth, even in limited circumstances. A radio host working out of Missouri, good friend of mine, has a favorite expression. She said, "Everything outside of your house is a lie." Which I would add.
Almost.
I would add, and so is a great deal of what we foolishly bring into our house.
Yeah. So you're saying, you know, you mentioned the problems with soy, you know, cottonseed oil, you know, these canola that, you know, the negative effects they have on our health. But how do they specifically rate to diabetes?
Yeah, I'll get to that.
Why? Okay.
I'll be getting to that.
All right.
Okay,
we have 22 minutes. All right.
Another story I want to tell you is about Monsanto. Monsanto, there are a lot of things, but one thing they're not stupid. They know people want omega-3 fatty acids, and they know why people want them, because they're beneficial. So guess what they've done?
Tell me.
In their soybeans, and they've genetically modified soybeans in such a way that they produce an omega-3 fatty acid. So the soybean oil, GMO soybean oil, the latest version of the GMO soybean oil, produces fake fish oil. Produces SDA, which is an omega-3 fatty acid, part of the omega-3 fatty acid complex. The Food and Drug Administration had already granted this fake oil what they call GRAS status, G-R-A-S.
Mm-hmm.
This means generally recognized as safe. They did this with only 16 weeks of study and preparation and no long-term trials on either animals or humans. How about that?
That's scary, scary, scary information.
I have no doubt that when this story appears on the TV set, people are going to flock to buy this fake fish oil from soybeans. And I cry when I think of that happening to them.
Well, that's why we're doing this broadcast. And that's why we're asking those that are listening to spread this information far and wide. I just want to stop here just briefly for a second. And remind you that you can get Dr. Smith's book directly from him. You can write him at his email, which is valley@FRIII.com. So that's valley@FRIII.com. And your post office box, Mr. Smith. Can you tell us that again slowly?
Okay, you can send me $29, cash, check, or money order. If you send cash, I don't recommend sending cash because too much of it gets lost in the mail. But if you do send cash, make sure you send it by certified mail. Make sure I get it.
Okay.
Anyway, send it to Thomas Smith, Post Office Box 7685.
7685.
Loveland, okay. Colorado. 80537.
80537. Okay. So for those of you who are going, oh, this is too much information, this is in his book, you know, and you can read it over and over and over again so that you really know this well. You really want to know the truth. You know, the truth
sets
you free.
I don't know what's going on in the fats and oils business. Most of our degenerative disease is historically traceable to the deterioration of the fats and oils business in America.
Absolutely. And so this is absolutely foundational for so many things, not just diabetes. As we talked about it when we first began, this relates to heart disease, peripheral vascular disease,
a fats and oils
macular
business,
degeneration.
Crisco
yes.
used to give away 2.5-pound cans of Crisco shortening free in order to get the housewives, who were the main purchasers of food in those days, in order to get them to buy their product. They'd try to get them hooked on it by giving them 2.5 pounds free, and then they'd claim that it was kosher. Of course it's kosher. It's not even food.
Goodness.
Talk about digestion and metabolism. Fats and oils, except for the very short chain ones, like butyric acid, do not dissolve in water. And so they must be assimilated differently from carbohydrates and proteins, which do dissolve in water. First, they're emulsified by the bile, which is produced by the liver, and stored for this purpose in the gallbladder. In this bile sort of acts like a soap. Then they must be brought out of the intestines into the system. This is done through the Peyer's patches in the lower part of the small intestine. From there, it goes into the lymph system. When it's finally released into the blood, the fats and oils are packaged in little transport containers called chylomicrons. These transport containers are attracted to water at one end and to fats and oils at the other. The end that attaches to the fats and oils, it sticks to the fats and oils, and the other end is what sees the water. That way, it's an artificial way of making them water soluble.
Right.
And because of this, they're able to be transported by the blood. If you didn't have this special mechanism to do this, they'd form little globules of fat. Like when you drop some oil in water, you see how the globules form?
Right.
Talk about the metabolic uses of fats and oils in the body. Fatty acids as phospholipids form the essential building blocks in our cellular membranes. They determine the fluidity or lack thereof of these membranes. We talked about this a little bit last time.
Yeah.
We were talking about how do you get insulin to bind correctly, and how do you get the GLUT4 transporters to travel to the capillary areas. And we got into that last time. Your brain is probably 60-80% fats. All your nerve sheaths, myelin, are all fats. These fats and oils are the essential precursors to the prostaglandin system of short-term regulating hormones. Omega-6 fatty acids are the precursors to the PG-1 and PG-2 series of prostaglandins. There are about 30 of these prostaglandins, and they occur in 3 different series. And they have regulatory effects on the body. PG-1, for example, keeps the blood platelets from sticking together. In our kidneys, they help to regulate urine flow and salt retention. It lowers blood pressure, slows cholesterol production. It lessens the inflammatory response, thus helping arthritis response. And by the way it slows... It slows cholesterol production is the good way. It's by lowering the inflammatory response. That's how it lowers cholesterol. That's a good way to do it. Any other way of lowering cholesterol is not a good way to do it. PG1 also improves nerve function, provides you a general sense of well-being, regulates calcium, helps the immune system. It limits the release of arachidonic acid from our cell membranes. Arachidonic acid is a bad fatty acid. It's a bad consequence of excess omega-6 fatty acids. PG2 is made from AA, arachidonic acid. It promotes platelet thickness. It causes the kidneys to retain salt and thereby water. It's an antagonist to PG1.
Okay.
PG3 is made from the omega-3 series oils. Its most important function is that it's the most powerful antagonist to the formation of PG2 and arachidonic acid, which basically limits inflammation and limits limits platelet thickness, stickiness.
Okay.
Now, if you have an omega-3 fatty acid deficiency, it'll often appear. It'll give you some symptoms. There'll be some things you can notice that might make you suspect you have this deficiency.
All right.
Growth retardation, weakness, vision and learning impairment, motor incoordination, tingling sensation in arms and legs, behavioral changes, most notable in children. This is this famous attention deficit disorder. It's almost entirely due to a deficiency in omega-3 fatty acids, and it clears up when you give them omega-3 fatty acids. They don't need some medication prescribed by the school. They just need omega-3 fatty acids. Omega-6 also has deficiency symptoms, although you're not likely to see a whole lot of them, unless you go on a very low-fat diet and you don't get omega-6s either. Eczema-like skin eruptions, loss of hair, liver and kidney degeneration.
Said earlier that we have way too many omega-6s in our diet, but isn't the problem really not just that there's a lot of 6, but that it's the quality of the 6? It's these...
Yeah.
They're so altered that...
You know, we talk about omega-6s and omega-3s as if, they were healthy omega-6s and omega-3s, but a lot of these omega-6s, for example, are trans fats. A lot of them are other isomers besides cis. They've been heat damaged, oxygen damaged. Anyway, a lack of omega-6s also produce behavioral disturbances, excessive perspiration and thirst, susceptibility to infections, poor wound healing. You see that a lot in diabetics. Sterility in males, miscarriage in females, and a lot of this other similar type systems.
So you can eat a bunch of bad omega-6s and still actually have a deficiency because they're so altered that they aren't the real healthy omega-6s that you need.
That's correct.
Right.
And since the omega-6s you get are, they typically come from the polyunsaturated oils that you get in the supermarket, virtually all of which come in transparent plastic bottles from room temperature grocery shelves.
And that's not even the worst part of it. Can you explain the oil process, how they get those oils to the shelf? Because people will be so repulsed by that, they'll never want to eat those oils again.
Yeah, well, there are two basic ways to separate the oil out from their seeds. First of all, before I get into that, I'd like to point out that with olives, the oil doesn't come from the seed. It comes from the pulp.
Okay.
Because it comes from the pulp, it gets pressed out at a low temperature. So the first pressing of the olive pulp is what they call virgin olive oil. And it's a low-temperature monounsaturated oil that's very, very healthy. And then they typically package it either in cans or opaque glass bottles, which retains its health. And the combination of low oxygen, protection against light, and low heat pressing, it gives you a fairly healthy oil. It's a monounsaturated oil. Now, in all the other oils that are available, they all come from seeds. And there are basically two ways to get the oil out of the seed. One way is to crush the oil up into a fine flour, and then cook it, and then wash it with gasoline. The gasoline dissolves the oil, and you filter the gasoline out, and then you evaporate the gasoline from the oil. You never quite get all the gasoline back out. It always is contaminated by the hexane or heptane gasoline mixtures. This is called solvent extraction. After solvent extraction, it goes through all the rest of the basic steps. Expeller pressed. In this method, the oil is crushed and cooked, and then is subjected to very high pressures in a hydraulic press. This forces the oil out. The oil is then subjected to a number of subsequent steps to degum it, refine it, bleach it, deodorize it. By the time it has become tasteless, and sometimes can't even be recognized by taste, you can take peanut oil, grape seed oil, peanut oil, canola oil, they all taste the same because they've all been through this process that completely destroys the character of the oil. Any useful thing that the seed might once have had has been removed. All the vitamins and minerals have been removed. Many of the phyto products are removed, and some of the ones that are dangerous. At no point in this process is the oil protected from heat, light, or oxygen, all of which completely destroy the omega-3 components and a lot of the omega-6 components. These polyunsaturated oils, as they're called, should never be used for cooking. I repeat that. They should be kept refrigerated in the home as well as in the warehouse and in the store. Ideally, you'll find them in glass, opaque glass bottles in a refrigerator when you buy them. Let's see.
So we have about 6 minutes left. So can you kind of hone in on how this affects diabetes?
How it affects what?
Diabetes.
Well,
what difference do these fats make just for diabetics specifically?
Well, we talked about the membrane connection last time, so I won't repeat that.
Okay.
It also affects the prostaglandin series. And the high preponderance of omega-6s producing, as they do, a great deal of PG2s, prostaglandin 2s, cause widespread inflammation throughout the body. This inflammation, by the way, is taken as a marker for diabetes. It's a marker for endogenous insulin, because insulin is the actual active ingredient in the inflammation, and it's facilitated by the PG2 prostaglandins that come from the omega-6s. So the connection between type 2 diabetes and these fats and oils that we've been talking about here is absolutely undeniable. There's no possible way to deny this. I have, for those of you who have a little bit of a scientific inclination and you want to do a little more, get a little more into depth, well, first I'd recommend my book. You can buy my book. It has a lot more depth in this stuff. But also, I'd also recommend a paper by Marlene Haig and Nola Despinar. The paper is entitled Dietary Fats, Fatty Acids, and Insulin Resistance, a Short Review of a Multifaceted Connection.
There are numerous connections. So it's dietary fats.
In the last few minutes we got to the show, that specifically connect these dietary fats and oils to diabetes.
Okay, can you tell us the name of that again? It's dietary fats.
Look up, get on the internet, and look up a paper. It's a paper is entitled "Dietary Fats, Fatty Acids, and Insulin Resistance: Short Review of a Multifaceted Connection."
Okay.
It's by Haig, H-A-A-G, and Dipenaar, D-I-P-P-E-N-A-A-R. It's from the Department of Physiology, University of Pretoria, South Africa. These people did a really good job of summarizing a lot of the connections, a lot more of the connections between dietary fats and oils and diabetes.
So what can people expect to notice from just changing to healthier fats and oils?
Well, if you get rid of the polyunsaturates, at least get rid of the three that we warned you about, the canola oil, cottonseed oil, and soybean oil. If you don't remember anything else out of this radio show, remember to take that stuff and any food that contains them out of your diet, completely and permanently.
So you got to read labels.
Got to read labels to do that. You may have to bring a little magnifying glass with you because these labels are often printed in very fine type. All right? Read the labels, identify what you're doing, and don't eat the stuff that poisons you. You should probably, we've had people start to receive results in as short a time as a week or 10 days.
Wow. And so
in my own case, I saw results in about 3 weeks. But I didn't get my blood sugar back to normal for about 3.5 months. And during the entire 3.5 months, I was intensely focused on this problem.
So when you're saying they'll begin to see some results, you're meaning that they're going to begin
lowered
to see their blood sugar levels
come
down.
Levels.
Okay.
Let me plug my book one more time here.
Absolutely.
You can get a lot of this information and a lot more besides in my book entitled Insulin or Silent Killer. Costs $29. Cash check or money order to Thomas Smith, Post Office Box 7685, Loveland, Colorado, 80537. But a lot of people, you know, I realize some of this we went through, particularly the naming conventions and the structure of the fatty acids and the glycerol. Some of this stuff may be a little technical for people who may be quite a few years away from their high school chemistry.
But without this information, you go to the store and you don't know what's okay and what's not okay. With this information,
you can make
the right choices. We have less than 1 minute, so I just want to thank everybody for listening. Thank you, Mr. Smith, so much for this information. This is like college level course here, and I really, really appreciate this. And I hope our listeners appreciate that we're making this free to the public and not charging people. I know so many other people who would charge you money to get this information, and so I just
my email website is valley@fri.com. I frequently get questions. Hardly a day goes by I don't have two or three email correspondents asking me questions about one thing or another.
So we're going
to
do
extent,
this.
possibly can, I always fully try to answer the questions as well as possible.
We're going
to
do this again next week, so everybody, you know, stay tuned. We're going to have more information, and so see us next week. All right. Oh, well, actually, I have a little bit more. So make sure, I'm going to send out a notice to everybody. I just want to say God bless you and thank you for listening. And, you know, listen to this over again. Send your family and friends to this. Get this information out. We want to save lives here. We want people to know what to eat and what not to eat. It's very simple. It doesn't have to be complicated. Once you know the truth, it's easy. So we hope you will join us again. Thank you so much for listening. God bless you.
God bless.